So tonight I want to surprise you by giving a talk on compassion. And in a way, as I mentioned, I will bring together both the practice that we've been doing during the day and also point to what we do tomorrow and make some connections, but in a way, give orientation for the continued practice, particularly what we explore tomorrow when we do compassion practice. And that is the design for really the rest of the retreat. And then towards the end, we'll focus on how we bring our practice into daily life. So I wanted to suggest how to listen to a talk as a form of practice. And one way is to try to stay present as you listen. Sometimes we approach the evening talk as entertainment. You've worked hard all day, just sit back and enjoy. But you can also, that's one option. Another option is to take it as a form of practice. So try to be present and listen from your heart. And often with a talk, we hear, I will talk for a while, but maybe there are only two or three things that are important for you. And you can listen to those and take them in. But it can be helpful to try to have a sense of being present in the body, not all of the attention, more cognitively. So as it were, listen with your heart, listen with your mind, listen with your body, listen with your presence. And if you notice yourself distracted, just come back, just as we do in our practice. So I want to talk about three areas. The first is the way that our metta practice connects with the other three ways of opening the heart, and some of the similarities between the practice, some ways that these practices are very similar. That's first. And then secondly, and thirdly, I want to talk about compassion. The second part will be more on some of the wisdom dimensions of compassion. How do we understand compassion more in terms of wisdom and mindfulness? And then the last will be on more on compassion as a heart practice. And ultimately, we bring all of this together. But in the short run, they're a little different, look a little different. So the aim of our practice and what we're particularly focusing on here is how to live more and more from kindness, from what we call the awakened heart. And it's a training and a practice, and it's not linear. There are ups and downs, and we sometimes feel more strongly in our hearts, and sometimes things happen and we don't even connect with our hearts, and that's normal. So we follow this guidance from the Metta Sutta. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. How do you take that as your guide for practice? How do you develop in that way? How do we develop in that way? And I mentioned that in the traditional text, it's often said that there's a quality of our being which is part of our sort of heart-mind, which is brightly shining. In the text, it's talked about being brightly shining, and it's linked especially with metta, and it's there for all of us, and it gets covered over. That's one way of talking about things. That another way to say this is that our basic kind heart is already there. And some of our practice is not so much to make it happen, but to see what covers it over. Maybe to say another way, to get out of the way a little bit. And this is true generally of our practice, that we understand our deeper wisdom and our kind hearts as natural capacities, but that for different reasons related to our conditioning, our personal conditioning, our social conditioning, maybe some of what's happened in our lives, that is particularly what's been difficult, that kind heart gets covered over. Maybe we think, I can't really show my heart, it's too vulnerable, or it's too dangerous. And maybe we've had experiences where we showed our kind hearts and other people attacked us or made fun of us or were in some ways telling us, if you do that, it's not so safe. How many people can relate to that? Yeah. It's very common. And yet we still try to develop this kind heart. You know, and maybe towards the end of the retreat, maybe some here, I can also talk about how do you open the heart and also take care of yourself? That's an interesting question, isn't it? How do you do that where there are some tendencies to not have that be so safe? From the 8th century, from Shantideva, from we would say now more Mahayana tradition, whenever catching sight of others, look upon them with an open, loving heart. So that's the, again, that's the aim. This is from Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, I say to you, I have decided to stick to love. For I know that love is ultimately the only answer to the problems of humanity. I say to myself that hate is too great a burden to bear. I have decided to love. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And so he talks about love, and we talk about metta, which is close. They are in the same family. Right? And compassion, it's a big family. Love, metta, compassion, joy, equanimity, gratitude, forgiveness, empathy. We could probably add others. And so this is the family that we are encouraging. In a way, it's our new family. And so we want to develop the kind heart, and we come here and we train. What we're doing here is a training, we could say. And it's not always easy. And there are challenges to the training. You know, one training difficulty is that we get distracted. Has anyone been distracted today? So maybe one half of the group been distracted, or one half raises the hands. Others were too distracted to listen to what I'm saying. So one of the ways that metta and these other practices develop is that we develop more concentration. You know, just as in the mindfulness, we develop the attention to the breath or some other focus. With the metta, we stay with the phrases over and over again, and that develops concentration. It develops in the original language, it's called samadhi. And it's a sense of, I don't know how it is in Hebrew, but in English, concentration sometimes has connotation of effort, and I will concentrate. And actually, in meditation, I don't even like to use the word concentration much, because there are too many confusions. It's about effort, try real hard. When in actuality, the essence of samadhi is relaxation. And so, but it's a combination of what we might call relaxed persistence. So we relax, but we keep on with the phrases. So that's not an easy combination, is it? Relaxed persistence. And so you can think of that for every session. And for some of us, we may have more relaxation, and we need a little more persistence. And for some of us, we have a lot of persistence, and we need more relaxation. So we can ask ourselves, what kind of balance do I have? Do you know persistence? I don't know what the Hebrew word is, of course. But is that clear? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so with the metta practice, it's just like with the breath, we just do one thing. We keep coming back. And this is our way of working with distraction. We keep coming back. We do only one thing. There's a beautiful line from the philosopher Kierkegaard, you know, from Denmark. He says, purity of heart is to will one thing. There's a certain beauty and purity in just doing one thing. Simplicity. And another, from the Christian tradition, there was a Russian Orthodox teacher from the 19th century named Theophane, and he said that dispersal of attention diminishes warmth. Do you understand that? That when we have less continual attention, the heart's not as warm. And so we want to have that continuity to stay with the metta phrases or however we're doing metta. The same thing with the breath. And so maybe one thing to say about this, staying with the phrase, I think I said it some this morning, but to say it a little more clearly, that when we're doing a practice to develop samadhi, we don't focus so much as we do in Vipassana on the different thoughts that come. I'm with the phrases, and thoughts come, I notice it, I just come back to the phrases. I don't have to make a note, planning, remembering. I just keep coming back. And so the basic idea is, when thoughts come and they just come for a little while, we notice them, we come back. We don't need to do anything with them. We don't inquire. We don't do that which we do in Vipassana. We just come back over and over. When something comes and it's there for a while, like maybe we have something comes up, maybe irritation or anger, and it stays for a while and it just stays, even if we notice it, it still stays. Then we often, and then by staying for a while, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something's there for a while, maybe a little less, then we could actually switch to mindfulness practice when it's really staying for a while. So one example would be sometimes in a meditation retreat, we might be doing the practice, we might be doing metta, and maybe there was some kind of a loss. Maybe someone we know died 3 months ago, and we never really had a time of grief. And so sometimes when we come to a retreat, that can come up. And if that comes up, we would give it some attention. We wouldn't sort of say, oh, go away, back to metta, right? If that's something like that happens, we would give it attention. And it's basically saying, this is important to be aware of, okay? Similarly, this is sort of one of the benefits, in a certain way, of metta practice or any kind of concentration practice. When there are physical challenges or pains, in Vipassana practice, we would say, stay with it, as long as it's not too much or not causing damage. We would say, stay with the pain, look into it, be present, hang out with the pain. With metta practice, we say, don't do that. So with metta practice, if there's pain and it stays for a while and it distracts you from the metta, change your posture, stand up, move. Anything that takes you away from the metta and the focus, aside from something like the grief that I was mentioning, we we want to try to stay with it. So if you have painful experiences just a little bit from sitting, getting stiff or something, you can stand up or shift your posture. So I call that in English we would say it's a perk, or it's a special benefit of metta practice. You don't have to spend too much time with pain. Okay. So just a few suggestions for deepening that concentration aspect or the samadhi aspect of metta. When you find yourself distracted, keep coming back, but keep it with relaxation. If you notice yourself judging yourself, I'm not doing so well, try to let go of that. Just keep coming back with that sense of persistence, but also ease and relaxation. Not to try too hard. Again, see if for yourself whether I have more of the effort and less of the relaxation, then you do a little more relaxation. If you are a little bit too relaxed, not as much effort to stay with the phrase, then a little more effort. So we look for that kind of balance. Another thing to know is that metta and the sense of kindness is mysterious in how it develops, not a linear process. We can be doing metta sometime and it seems dry. And then 5 minutes later, can feel very alive. Very interesting. My first time I ever did metta, I think I was at Gaia House, the old Gaia House. I was doing a retreat and I did, a week of metta. And I had no instruction. I was just doing it on my own. It was actually before there were started to be metta retreats in the West. So I did it on my own, and I didn't seem to be having any results at all. And I was doing it for many days. But I was dedicated, maybe foolish, but dedicated. But I think, no, not foolish. I was very, very good student. And I would keep on meditating and no results, kind of dry, and I thought maybe metta's not for me. I'll stick with Vipassana. And then one day during breakfast, I wasn't even doing the metta practice, or maybe after breakfast, and I was just walking around, and I noticed myself say to myself, "I love you." I said, "Whoa." So it just came out of nowhere, right? And sometimes the metta's like that. You keep on doing the practice, and sometimes it just comes, and where does it come from? And so then later I became teacher of metta. Right? So it happens like that. There are other stories like that. Sharon Salzberg tells a story like that. Sharon Salzberg is a well-known teacher, and she also was just trying metta before the really had good instructions. I was trying it, and also for her, nothing was happening so much. And I think she was doing it a few days and thinking, it's not working. And then she had to go to a meeting because there was had to finish her practice. There was some kind of a conflict in the community and her help was needed. And she was in a little bit of a rush and she knocked over a vase. I think it broke. And she said to herself, "You're a klutz." Is that kind of... It's kind of Yiddish slang. And she said, "You're a klutz." And then right the next moment, she said, "You're a klutz." You know what that means?
Yeah.
Okay, it means like clumsy or, you're inadequate in how you move. Right? And she said, "You are a klutz and I love you."
Yeah.
Same thing. It was kind of, it came out of nowhere. And she said, "Whoa. Why did that happen?" Right? And so just know that the development of metta has a mysterious aspect. So not to think, oh, it's working or not working. It keeps changing. Okay. One thing to do that's important also for getting more steady is to sometimes have some discipline when you have repetitive thoughts. Suppose you have the same thought you go back to, maybe something from last week, right? Anyone have some two or three repetitive thoughts that keep on surfacing, right? It's quite common. One thing you can do with your practice sometimes with this kind of practice is gently but firmly say, not now, with the repetitive thoughts. That's very helpful for deepening samadhi. Okay, just say, you notice the repetitive thought, not now. Just a little bit like training a puppy. Okay, or training a dog. Okay. So a second challenge that can be there with metta practice and the other heart practices is that we don't feel connected to the heart. Right? We're practicing and it's a little bit dry. We have a technical term we use sometimes for very dry metta. We call it, we use a term that makes it sound like we're, the phrases are like reading from the phone book. We call it phone book metta. So most of us, for our pleasure, do not read from the phone book, right? This is not so interesting. And sometimes the metta can feel like that, right? So that's an issue. But what we're really trying to do is have the kind of the kind heart be more and more present. And so I like to use the phrase that we're learning to lead with the heart. And so some of what we do is some of what surfaces when we practice these heart practices is that which gets in the way turns up. You know, that which is blocking the heart shows up. So different things come and we can notice them. We notice, for example, we were talking about this in one of the groups, maybe we notice that there's a lot of self-judgment, negative thoughts towards self. Anyone experienced that in the last period of time? So it's quite common, right? So we can notice that. And sometimes that comes up and it's like calling for our attention. And it's quite common when we do practices related to the heart that certain things come up that we didn't even know were so strong. Right? When we do metta retreats, people have the most extreme dreams of more than Vipassana retreats. And we notice that. You know, people come to me in the morning and say, last night I dreamed I was a murderer. Is this my true nature? And we say, no, it's very normal. You know, and so there can be those. Anyone have sometimes extreme dreams? Yeah, so it's common not to draw any conclusions. Actually, it's a good sign. Something is coming through. So there can be things that come up. So we sometimes talk about these heart practices as a process of purification. That which blocks the heart comes to more to the surface. And so it's not always easy, right? Not always pleasant. And so if that's happening, know that this is part can be part of purification. You know, and so it could be self-judgment. It could be more unconscious material. You know, all of us have a lot of unconscious material, from social conditioning, from family, from maybe difficult things that happened when we were younger. And these things come up. And sometimes it's hard to tell that they're there, but that it happens. And we try to work with them as best we can. So sometimes it's reactivity. Sometimes it's self-judgment, sometimes it's blaming people around or being angry or something like that. And we just keep on practicing with it. Again, if it's happening a lot, maybe we switch to the mindfulness practice. Right? If it's happening, if we're having anger that goes on for a while. And just to know that this is part of the process, this is normal that these things happen. Then I wanted to just also say a few words about how the different practices are connected. And I mentioned, I think first night, that you know we can think of loving kindness as basically the kind open heart. We think of compassion as what happens when that kind open heart meets difficulty or pain or suffering. Mudita, her joy, when that kind open heart meets something, someone's happy, joyful, or we connect with beauty. There is a kind of a joy that develops. And then the equanimity holds everything. It's able to hold everything that's happening with care, but also with wisdom. And there's a nice, I have a something that I found from the Tibetan tradition, from one of the great teachers from Tibetan tradition named Longchenpa, who was, I think, from, 12th or 13th century. But he's revered as almost like a second Buddha in Tibet. And he said this, out of the soil of metta grows the beautiful bloom of compassion, to be watered by tears of joy under the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. So maybe I put that, post that. It's very beautiful. So compassion is our second heart quality, very related to metta. Again, it's the kind open heart. In the tradition, it said, when there is pain or difficulty or suffering, the heart quivers. There's another word that's close to compassion. Compassion is karuna, many of you know. And there's another word called anukampa, which is very close to compassion. And it actually is that when we're with pain, there's almost like a kind of trembling and shaking that occurs. And it, you know, something is, and then maybe it's more internal, right? Maybe when you're with something painful or see yourself suffering or other suffering, there can be a kind of an internal shaking, right? A kind of something is, but here it's more the compassion, the true compassion is more like a musical instrument. It's resonating, right? It's like a vibration in when there's something difficult or painful. When we connect the compassion practice to the wisdom practice, and we look at our usual attitude towards what is unpleasant or painful, or when they're suffering, we notice that our conditioning is not to want to be with what's painful, right? The conditioning is to get rid of the unpleasant. Push it away. I don't want that. Whether it's unpleasant body sensation, unpleasant emotion, unpleasant interaction with another person, our conditioning is to not be with the unpleasant. And so with compassion practice, we deliberately are willing to be with the unpleasant, with what's painful. So it goes very strongly against our conditioning. And it's not easy, right? So we sometimes say that compassion practice can be the hardest of these because we're hanging out with what can be painful, with someone else's suffering at times. And there's a very important teaching that is a wisdom teaching that I wanted to share. It's maybe my favorite teaching from the Buddha. I probably taught it 2 years ago. It's called the Teaching of the Two Arrows. And this gives us a perspective. How many of you know the Teaching of the Two Arrows? Yeah, it's a very important teaching. And it gives us a wisdom perspective, sort of the background for why it can be difficult to open to compassion, because it's opening to what's unpleasant. So here the teaching is like this. The Buddha was talking to a group of practitioners, and he asked them a question. Everyone at times experiences the unpleasant. And we could think of the unpleasant as, again, unpleasant sensations, sometimes unpleasant emotions, unpleasant thoughts, unpleasant interactions, maybe sometimes injustice, is unfairness, lack of fairness. He says, everyone at times experiences the unpleasant. How is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner. They did not answer his question. And so he answered his own question, which was a very common teaching technique. And so he said, when we have an unpleasant experience, it's like being shot by an arrow. And he said, this is the first arrow. And all of us at times are shot by the first arrow. We have unpleasant experiences in the different ways I mentioned. Practitioners, as well as non-practitioners, are the same in this. Sometimes we are shot by the first arrow. And by the way, I'm using the word practitioner, or I'm using the word non-practitioner to mean also us when we're not practicing, just to be clear. Just by the fact that you come to a meditation retreat doesn't mean that 1 week from now you will have a sense of practice if something difficult happens. Hopefully, yes, but so just to be clear. So it's not like if you go to a retreat, then you're cool. You're always cool. Mm-hmm. So he said, how there is a difference is that the practitioner, the non-practitioner, when shot by the first arrow, tends to shoot a second arrow, and we would say at oneself or at others. And this actually increases the pain. And the practitioner learns not to do that. Okay, so let me give some examples. In the text, the Buddha's emphasis was particularly on what was unpleasant physically, but I'll talk about different forms. And so, for example, when we have what we call physical pain or physically unpleasant experiences, we will tend to tense. We will tend to react, and there's tension in the body. And Zohar mentioned yesterday something which has been very important for me also, to know that for some people, or for some types of chronic pain, as she mentioned, they find that, I heard actually 80%, some doctors say as much as 80% of what they experience as pain is not the original sensation, but it's the reaction, it's the second arrow. In other words, so if you can teach them meditation, and this was the first area where meditation was applied in the medical field, because if you can reduce the second arrow, or a lot of it, all of a sudden you still have pain, you still have maybe 20-30%, but you don't have 100%. So it's big, it's huge, right? And so that's one way we shoot the second arrow. Another way is maybe I have a difficult emotion, and it's there, and maybe then I blame myself for it, or I judge someone else, or I have an interaction, you know, with someone. I have an interaction with my partner, and I say something, and it takes 5 seconds, and then I blame myself for the next 3 weeks. Anyone ever done that? Yeah. So some version of that's the second arrow, right? That's shooting the second arrow. You know, a lot of conflicts in the world are two groups shooting second arrows at each other. You know, we have received pain, we will inflict pain on you. And then the other side, we have received pain, we will inflict pain on you, and it goes in a circle. Right? It's no two sides shooting second arrows at each other, and it keeps this. Yeah. So what we learn to do is we learn how to not shoot the second arrow. Not easy, right? And if we were doing, in all the aspects of practice and training, we would learn a lot of different ways not to do that. And I'll just be brief about that. One of the ways is in our Vipassana practice that we learn to be present with what's unpleasant. You know, when it's not causing harm, we learn how to be with physically unpleasant, and we are not so conditioned to react, right? And so that's the basis, really. We have to have that capacity to to be with the unpleasant, to do compassion practice. Right? So that kind of teaching is very important. That, and you know, in our mindfulness practice, it's being able to notice how the unpleasant experience leads to wanting to push away and then pushing away automatically. And we can study that in our practice. And we learn how to see that. We call that reactivity. We learn how to see that. And so for our compassion practice, we have to be willing to be with the unpleasant. This is a poem from a writer, I think, I don't know, maybe either, I forget, Ireland or Britain, I forget. Do you know David White, where he?
Yeah, he's British, north of England, but he's of Irish origin.
Irish, so I was right with both. So he's Irish heritage, but lives in Britain. Okay.
Well, he actually lives in the U.S.
All right. Okay. He lives, okay, so. Anyway, very, very, very good poet. So it's White, spelled W-H-Y-T-E. And he says this is called the Well of Grief. Those who would not slip beneath the still surface on the Well of Grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink. So did you get that? Poetry in different language, a little harder, is basically saying, if you're not willing to go into the pain of grief, you won't know your own depth. You won't know who you are, really. We'll never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. So our compassion practice is based on the capacity to be willing to be with suffering, to be with what's difficult. And one way that we can, I think it's quite, it's really actually to be, in English, pain and suffering are sometimes used the same. And I would kind of distinguish them and say that pain is the first arrow and suffering is the second arrow. Suffering is the reaction. You know, as we say, the resistance to the present moment. And so I don't know how that distinction is in Hebrew, but in English, it's important to make a distinction between first arrow and second arrow. They're different. We open in compassion to both of them, but it's helpful to know the difference. So there really are two aspects of compassion. One is more internal. It's really the way that we have this sense of resonating with our own pain or suffering or that of someone else. And this is where we have that quivering of the heart. We have a sense, and sometimes it has aspects of empathy, that we have a sense of, oh, I know some what that's like. Right? Or I can feel that in some way. And there's an inner sense of, and some also that inner sense can be, oh, they're suffering, and I want this person not to suffer so much. That's compassion. So compassion has this aspect of both having the feeling of knowing what it's like, and also the wish that it may end. That the suffering may end. And sometimes this is just at the feeling level, and sometimes the compassion takes the form of action. So there's both, we could say, a receptive aspect of compassion, also active. You know? And in our meditation, we're especially developing more the receptive, more the inner dimension. But when we go home, the compassion is also expressed through helping others, through being there when people are having difficulty or pain or suffering. And it could be also to act in the world, to meet the suffering of the world and try to have it be less. Right? And many of us do that work in different ways, whether, you know, whether in medical work, nursing, being a doctor, psychotherapy, physical therapy, probably, I don't know, a large number of you. How many of you in some way meet pain and suffering in your work? Yeah, that's a lot. So you've already probably developed a lot of compassion. So these inner practices can help it be stronger. And you can actually have that sense, you can take your daily work and say, I want to bring compassion and have that active sense of compassion. One thing they find in the research is that if you're really coming from compassion, there's not burnout. It's very interesting, maybe. Yeah. That we get burned out a little bit. Maybe I'll talk about that later because it's a little bit technical. But because another way that we, you know, one of the dangers of opening to pain and suffering is that we get burnout or too much, right? And there are different ways to work with that. One of them is to sometimes pull back, do less. Sometimes that's hard. About 1 month ago, I met with about 60 doctors and nurses in California. And we were doing different practices. They had a one-day retreat, and I was invited to work with them. And they told me that a lot of our challenges is because they make us work too hard. In other words, the issues are institutional. And I was very clear that personal practices can only go so far when they're institutional issues or larger social issues, right? So you have to do both. And I didn't want so I said, both do the inner practices and raise your voice about the institutional issues, which they were doing. They were doing that quite strongly, you know, very well. I think there will be changes, right? One of the teachings that we haven't mentioned yet is the teaching of how with each of these heart qualities, there can be distortions of the heart qualities. Like there can be something that looks like the genuine metta or genuine compassion, which is a little bit different. So partly we want to look out for this. And so in the Buddhist tradition, these are called near enemies. And probably some of you know that term. In English, near enemies, we sometimes say near misses. So these are something that kind of looks like metta or love, but it's a little bit distorted. So this would be where we have warmth and kindness, but we are grasping. Maybe we have love, but we're possessive or grasping. That would be a distortion, right?
That's for metta.
For compassion, the traditional distortion is pity. I don't know. So, do you know that word?
Okay.
In pity. So that means that you may have a sense. There's some compassion there, but it's a little bit distorted. So I was thinking of a friend who lives in a wheelchair, and he told me a woman came up to him and she said, I admire you so much. If it was me, I would kill myself. So, so that's a distorted version of compassion, right? But there's something there. It's not just nothing, right? There's some feeling there, but it's a little bit distorted because she is setting herself as different. Pity is a little bit of distance, right? So we want to look out for that. And there's also another distortion which the Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa, he talked about idiot compassion. Do you know that one? Yeah. Do you want to know about idiot compassion? So that's when we just are kind of, we're compassionate without any wisdom. You know, we see someone who, I don't know, what would be an example? Maybe I see someone who's going through a hard time, and actually maybe there's some learning occurring. and I just want to make everything okay for this person. And so I cut out, you know, I cut and make the learning impossible. You know, and this can be something, even parents can do that. Does that make some sense?
Yeah,
so it actually occurs because I'm a little bit scared of the difficulty. And there's some compassion, but it doesn't have wisdom. It doesn't, in this example, I don't have the wisdom that the person could be learning something for the difficulty. I just want to end it, mostly because I don't like it. Right, that would be idiot compassion. So look out for idiot and compassion tomorrow. Okay. Maybe I'll just say a few more things about compassion. What are some practices that we can do? I'll mention a few practices. One of them, of course, is that when we are with our own pain or suffering, with the first or second arrow, in our mindfulness practice, we're actually developing compassion. When I can be present with my own difficulties and just hold it, compassion develops naturally. When I'm not just trying to get rid of my difficulties, there can be a kind of compassion. I say, oh, this is hard, isn't it? Right? And we can have some compassion for ourselves. That's a major way that compassion develops. We can do the compassion practice that we'll do tomorrow, which is very much like the metta practice. The main form uses phrases. You know, the phrase that I use, for example, is, may you be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. And so we may do that towards ourselves and towards others. We may develop compassion towards others by another practice is by being willing to be with friends, family, or sometimes in our work with people who are suffering, having difficulty, and being willing to do that. Maybe even taking it as a practice to, you know, you have friends who are having a hard time, you seek them out. You're there for them, you know. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, do not avoid contact with suffering or close your eyes before suffering. Do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Find ways to be with those who are suffering, by all means, including personal contact and visits, images, or sound. By such means, awaken yourself and others to the reality of suffering in the world. So it can be an active practice where we don't close our eyes to the suffering, you know. Another, there's a very good self-compassion practice, which some of you may know, comes from Kristen Neff. Anyone know her work? Yeah, I think quite influential. And this is, I'll give you this, very simple practice, three parts. It's a self-compassion practice. Something is happening that's difficult, okay? Maybe in the moment, or you can also do this for something that happened in the past. But here, we'll especially do it as something in the moment. And you say to yourself something like, this is hard, isn't it? And you say, yes, it's hard. You just sit there saying, this is hard. You know, I'm suffering some. And the first step is just recognizing what's happening. And second step, and this really is more using mindfulness, there's suffering happening. And maybe you feel it some. Second step is to know, and you reflect, suffering is part of life. It's natural. It's something that's part of being a human being. That's part two. And you go there. You realize it's not just me, it's part of human life. We all experience this. And then step three is you offer some kind of way of being kind to yourself. It could be saying something to yourself, maybe a phrase. It could be you almost like hold yourself, right? So some way that you wish well for yourself, maybe say, can I, whatever, you know, this is a hard time now, let me be as kind as possible to myself. So first step, recognize there's difficulty. Second, know that it's part of being a human being. And third step, to offer yourself some kind words or some gestures. So that's another practice we can do. Maybe I can post that on the board. Yeah. Okay. The Buddha also counseled people to be with those who are having difficulty. There's a story where there was someone who was very sick and had actually in the text it had dysentery, and the other monks and were not visiting, not noticing this person was sick. And the Buddha said, you need to notice when someone is suffering. He said, whoever would tend to me would tend to the sick. Right? So there's that invocation to bring the compassion to others. And when we have the capacity also to bring compassion to the world. It's very much in need. There's so much pain and suffering in the world. What can I do to help? You know, I was very interested. Last day or two, I read about the history of Endor and also the history of Mount Tabor. Do you know that there have been a lot of battles around here? Starting a long time ago. You know, there were, Mount Tabor has just had a lot of battles. A lot of people have died around here. You know, this was during one of the rebellions against the Romans. This was like 55 before the Common Era. You know, there was a big battle between, I think, there was an army of 30,000 Judeans and 10,000 Jewish people were killed right near here. It's right on the land, right? There's a lot of suffering right here. You go to almost any place in the world and there's some suffering there. I live in California. I live not far from where there was genocide of native people, right? Not too far. You know, how do you bring that into your mind, right? And so I read the history, and Mount Tabor has just had a lot of battles, you know, almost every 100 years or so. You know, and there were different battles with the Romans. There was, you know, battles between the Crusaders and the Islamic rulers, and it just goes on and on. So we know there's just this history of suffering everywhere we go, right? And, you know, how many of you know the history of Mount Tabor? Okay, so maybe I know more than you? Okay. And so just to know that. So I'll just close with a few images. In Mahayana tradition, there's the goddess Kuan Yin. Many of you know Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin is the Bodhisattva of compassion. Bodhisattva is a being dedicated both to awakening and to helping others. And Kuan Yin, she's focused on compassion. It's said that she is the one who hears the cries of the world. And she's sometimes sitting there, she's willing to hear the cries of the world. Now maybe I'll finish just with something from the Dalai Lama. This sort of summarizes everything. It's very brief, so here it goes. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. The end. So if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Okay. So that will be that's an introduction to our practice tomorrow. Okay? So let's just sit for a moment. So just to see what has been helpful from the talk, maybe one or two or three things especially. So thank you for your very kind attention. And we have about a half hour of walking now. And we come back at 9 for sitting. We'll also continue with the chanting. And we'll do chanting at the end of the day, every day. Okay?